Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Baruch Spinoza, narrated by Charlton Heston, Part 5.
According to Spinoza, all things in the world manifest the eternal power and activity of God, who is synonymous with nature. God is omnipresent, an indwelling power which we find in the natural order. Nothing happens by chance in this world, for all things are determined according to the laws of divine nature. Nothing happens in this world for any divine purpose. God's active self-expression has no purpose. According to Spinoza, this is the world as reason reveals it to us, purposeless, deterministic, and governed by natural laws that were not ordained with our well-being in mind. And as reason reveals what the world's like, reason can also reveal how we should live in such a world if we're to find happiness, and in Spinoza's terms, salvation. Immediately after describing this basic character of reality, Spinoza reminds us that he has a practical purpose.
I pass now to explaining those things which must necessarily follow from the essence of God, or the infinite and eternal being. Not indeed all of them, for we have demonstrated that infinitely many things must follow from it in infinitely many ways, but only those that can lead us by the hand, as it were, to the knowledge of the human mind and its highest blessedness.
Spinoza emphasizes the importance of understanding the human mind for a number of reasons. First, he's interested in questions about knowledge, as all philosophers are. How much do we know? What are the sources of our ignorance and of our mistakes? These questions can't be answered without understanding something about the nature of the mind itself. Second, and more importantly, Spinoza emphasizes an understanding of the mind because happiness and unhappiness are states of mind. He holds that in order to understand our greatest happiness, our highest blessedness, we must understand our own minds. Thus, the second part of Spinoza's ethics is called Of the Nature and Origin of the Mind. Questions about the human mind are as old as philosophy itself. It seems obvious enough that human beings have both a body and a mind, but just what the mind is and how it's related to the body is profoundly mysterious. Spinoza's theory of the mind is best understood by comparing it with the views of his immediate predecessor, the French philosopher René Descartes. According to Descartes, there are two distinct kinds of created substances in the world, physical substance and mental substance. The entire physical world consists of one substance which is characterized by spatial properties. On the other hand, every human mind, in Descartes' view, is an individual mental substance characterized by thought. By claiming this, Descartes credited to each mind the power of self-determination. He thereby sought to justify our everyday belief in human free will. In many ways, Descartes' theory is a commonsensical view, but it's a theory that has obvious and serious problems. Spinoza recognized them and sought to resolve them by offering a more coherent alternative. The most important difficulty of Descartes' view is that it doesn't explain how two substances, one completely non-physical, the other utterly physical, can interact with each other, as our minds and bodies surely do. Descartes' view of the mind has been said to be that of a ghost in a machine, but it's not clear how such a ghost could control a machine. If your decision to phone a friend is something that happens in your entirely non-physical mind, how can this decision make your physical body pick up the telephone and dial? How can something non-physical cause something physical to happen? Also, if seeing an apple is a physical event, light reflecting off the apple and entering the eyes, how can it cause the mental event of believing that there's an apple there? To answer these difficulties, Descartes claimed that there is in the brain a tiny, very easily movable organ called the pineal gland. This gland is said to be so sensitive that although it is physical, it can be moved by mere thoughts, which are not physical at all. And though it is itself purely physical, it can cause things such as beliefs to happen in the non-physical mind. This is Descartes' proposed answer to the problem of interaction between the mind and the body, that is, of mental substance and physical substance. Spinoza, in spite of his profound respect for Descartes, found this view utterly unconvincing.
I cannot wonder enough that a philosopher of his caliber, one who had firmly decided to deduce nothing except from principles known through themselves, and to affirm nothing which he did not perceive clearly and distinctly, one who had so often censured the scholastics for wishing to explain things by occult qualities, that such a philosopher would assume a hypothesis more occult than any occult quality. What, I ask, does he understand by the union of the mind and the body? What clear and distinct concept does he have of a thought so closely united to some little portion of matter? Indeed, I wish that he had explained this union.
But Spinoza's objections go deeper than Descartes' failure to explain the interaction of mind and body. Descartes held that the mind and the body are different substances. But as we've seen, he says there's only one substance, and that this one substance must be infinite and eternal. Thus, minds and bodies can't be different substances. But if they're not substances, what are they? Spinoza holds that God's infinite power must be expressed in infinitely many ways. As we saw, this means in part that there is an infinite series of modes, all causally related in a single natural system. But Spinoza also holds that in addition to the modes themselves, there must be infinitely many ways in which this series of modes is expressed. There are infinitely many ways in which the power of God and the modes that flow from that power can be conceived. These ways are called attributes. Spinoza doesn't say why, but for some reason we're capable of grasping only two of these attributes, thought and extension. In this way, he argues that mental things and physical things are not different substances, but different ways in which the one substance is expressed, different ways in which we can conceive the orderly series of modes. This view has powerful consequences for understanding the mind and the body, so it's important that we make it clear. Spinoza is claiming that God's power is expressed as an infinite, ordered series of modes under the attribute of thought, and is also expressed as an infinite, ordered series of modes under the attribute of extension. The modes, when conceived through the attribute of thought, are known as ideas. When conceived through the attribute of extension, they're known as physical things. But Spinoza emphasizes that this distinction between the attributes does not mean that there are two substances.
The thinking substance and extended substance are one and the same substance, which is now comprehended under this attribute, now under that. So also, a mode of extension and the idea of that mode are one and the same thing, but expressed in two ways.
It follows, then, that the causal order found among the modes of extension will be reflected in the ordered series of ideas. Spinoza confirms this.
The order and connection of ideas is the same as the order and connection of things.
This means that for every mode of extension, every physical object in the world, there's an exactly corresponding mode of thought. There's an idea of that object. Spinoza sometimes speaks of all the modes of thought together as the intellect of God, or even the mind of God. But we must always remember that terms like the mind of God refer to the infinite order of modes under the attribute of thought, an order corresponding exactly to the order of modes under the attribute of extension. You could say that the order of material things and the order of ideas run exactly parallel with each other. But that'd be a little misleading, since these are not two different orders, but one order of modes expressed in two different ways. One order of modes is expressed as physical objects and as ideas of those objects. Spinoza was not a materialist. He didn't believe that mind somehow arises from matter, though some have mistakenly interpreted him this way. Nor did he believe that material nature is really mental, though some have misread him in this as well. Spinoza believed that mind and matter are two different ways in which the ordered activity of substance is manifest. Having thus laid the groundwork, Spinoza is ready to address the question of the human mind. The mind, according to him, is made up of ideas. It's not a thing which has ideas. The mind is ideas. Certain ideas, certain modes of substance expressed through the attribute of thought. Spinoza draws the necessary conclusion.
From this it follows that the human mind is a part of the infinite intellect of God. Therefore, when we say that the human mind perceives this or that, we are saying nothing but that God, not insofar as he is infinite, but insofar as he constitutes the human mind, has this or that idea.
Our minds are parts of the infinite mind of God. But the emphasis here must be on the word part, for God has infinitely many ideas. God has an idea of each thing in the universe, but our minds consist of only a few of those ideas. Which ones? Which of God's ideas constitute your mind or my mind? According to Spinoza, the ideas that constitute your mind are the ideas of your body. Each individual's mind is made up of those of God's ideas that are the ideas of that individual's body. This is a strange view, to say the least, and Spinoza knows it won't be readily accepted. Thus he says,
"Here, no doubt, my readers will come to a halt and think of many things which will give them pause. For this reason, I ask that they continue on with me slowly, step by step, and make no judgment on these matters until they have read through them all."
Let us come to a halt for a minute and think of some of the interesting implications and some of the problems of this view. First, it's important to note that Spinoza's view offers an answer to the perplexing problem of how the mind is related to the brain. Spinoza says that the mind and the brain are not two different things, but two different ways of conceiving one thing. When someone talks about his beliefs or desires, and when the neurophysiologist talks about processes in the brain, they're both talking about the same thing, but they're describing this thing in two different ways. As an analogy, you could consider the audio tape I'm recording this on. It can truly be described as a presentation of Spinoza's philosophy. Also, it can truly be described as a series of tiny magnetic charges embedded in a plastic film. Two different ways of truly describing one thing. So too, in Spinoza's view, talking about our beliefs and ideas and talking about our brain processes are two ways of truly describing one thing. Still, Spinoza applies this theory all across the board in a way that has some consequences that seem strange. If our minds are God's idea of our bodies, and if God has an idea not only of each human body, but of every physical thing, then it would seem that every physical thing must have a mind. In a sense, Spinoza accepts this implication of his view. He says,
"The propositions we have advanced thus far have been entirely general, applying not more to men than to other individual things, all of which, though in different degrees, are animated."
The Latin word which is translated as animated is animata. It means having an anima, a soul or a mind. In saying that everything has a mind, Spinoza is saying only that there is in God an idea of every individual thing. He's saying that for every physical object viewed under the attribute of extension, there's also an idea of that object under the attribute of thought. But this doesn't mean that trees and rocks are sitting around thinking the way we do. The complexity of a mind depends on the structure and capacities of the physical thing that embodies that mind. So Spinoza says,
"We cannot deny that ideas differ among themselves, as the objects themselves do, and that one is more excellent than the other, just as the object of the one is more excellent than the object of the other. And so, to determine what is the difference between the human mind and the others, and how it surpasses them, it is necessary for us to know the nature of its object, that is, of the human body."
Spinoza provides a basic theory of what the human body is like and how it differs from other bodies. His theory is heavily influenced by the science of his time, but it's also highly original in describing how living organisms are different from other physical things. In Spinoza's view, the physical universe is made up of infinitely many small corpuscles, rather like atoms, which he refers to as simplest bodies. These simplest bodies are either in motion or at rest, and their motion or rest is determined by their interactions with other simple bodies around them. You get the image of lots of little particles bouncing off one another, determining each other's movements based on the laws of physical motion and geometry. This is all at the level of the smallest bodies, or what might be called the micro level. Our own bodies and the things most familiar to us are larger, more complex physical things that are made up of many simple small bodies. Spinoza calls these macroscale things composite bodies. He explains them somewhat technically as follows.
When a number of bodies of the same or different magnitude form close contact with one another through the pressure of other bodies upon them, or if they are moving at the same time or different rates of speed so as to preserve an unvarying relation of movement among themselves, these bodies are said to be united with one another, and all together to form one body or individual thing, which is distinguished from other things through this union of bodies.
So, a composite body exists when its parts maintain an unvarying relation of movement among themselves. This means when a man walks across the street, he remains the same individual even though his physical position is changed. The parts that make up his body all move together, maintaining the same positions and motions relative to one another. And even though today's scientists tell us that the cells that make up our bodies are replaced every few years, still we remain the same individuals, for the cells generally maintain a constant position and motion relative to one another throughout all of the replacements. Spinoza says that every individual thing in the universe endeavors to maintain its own characteristic internal relations of motion, even as it undergoes different changes and influences. Indeed, this tendency to preserve physical integrity is what characterizes the individual physical thing as an individual. Spinoza calls this endeavor for self-preservation a thing's individual essence. He says,
everything, insofar as it is in itself, endeavors to persist in its own being. This endeavor is nothing else but the actual essence of the thing in question.
This tendency towards self-preservation is nothing strange or magical. It's just the way the laws of nature work together to produce and maintain physical objects and living organisms. The individuals that really interest Spinoza are, of course, human beings. But it's important to note that his account of composite bodies is not limited to people. His view allows us to say that in a certain sense, very large and complex things can be viewed as individual bodies if their parts tend to maintain a constant motion relative to one another. For example, an ecological system, such as a marsh, might be considered a large composite individual because it tends to maintain its physical integrity despite many disturbing influences. An ant is an individual composite body, but it's also part of a larger composite individual, the entire ant colony. But of course, the colony is only part of a yet larger whole, the local ecological system. Spinoza emphasizes that what can be viewed as a whole individual from one perspective can also be seen as just a part of a greater individual when viewed from the larger perspective.
And if we proceed in this way to infinity, we shall easily conceive that the whole of nature is one individual whose parts, that is, all bodies, vary in infinite ways without any change of the whole individual.
This is Spinoza's remarkably modern view of the physical world. The world's an infinitely large totality, made up of parts which in turn are made up of smaller parts, all the way down to the simplest, smallest particles. The human body, in this view, is a middle-sized composite body, a complex, finite mode of substance expressed through the attribute of extension. Like all other physical things, it's characterized both by a constant relative motion and rest among its parts, and by an endeavor to maintain its physical integrity in the surrounding environment. The body constantly interacts with things around it. Some of these interactions are essential to its survival, such as food or oxygen.
the human body needs for its preservation a great many other bodies, by which, as it were, it is continually regenerated.
Some of the body's interactions with other things threaten its survival. For example, encountering wild beasts or drinking poison. And many interactions alter the body slightly without contributing either to its survival or its demise. As noted earlier, Spinoza holds that this entire complex physical order is also expressed as an order of ideas under the attribute of thought. The human mind, he says, is the complex idea of the human body, and the mind stands in the same causal relation to other ideas as the body stands to other physical things. When the body is influenced or affected by anything in the environment, the mind is likewise influenced or affected by the idea of that thing. Since the human body can be affected in many ways by many things, so too our minds can be affected by very many ideas of other things. And as we'll see, herein lies the basis of Spinoza's account of human error and human knowledge.
This is the end of Part 5. Please download Part 6 to continue.